The expectation maximization algorithm. This is one of the major topics in this course. I would say it's one of the major developments in the field in the past 20 years or so. In the mid-80s, people began to work extensively with hidden Markov models, which we will talk about next. But a lot of them didn't understand that theory was rooted in the EM theorem. Over the next 20 years or so, people began to understand that the EM theorem was much more general than hidden Markov models and could be applied to the estimate of almost any parameter using statistical methods. So since then, the EM has sort of become an approach used to estimate parameters of just about any kind of a model where you want to essentially maximize the likelihood or something like that. So it's become very important over the last 20 years. In fact, it's the equivalent to statistics, I would say, of mean squared error minimization in signal processing. Really what's happened is we've replaced many approaches that were based on mean squared error minimization with optimization or maximization of likelihoods using the EM. So it's a tool. It's a very general tool. Today we will talk about it in a very general way, and we'll go through the EM theorem and derive the results. It's a fairly straightforward proof. But you'll be left with the feeling that, well, what did we just prove? What was the use of that? So the next class we'll talk about hidden Markov models and how this is actually used to build hidden Markov models. So expectation maximization, or EM as it's known, is an approach that is used in many ways to find maximum likelihood estimates of parameters in probabilistic models. So we're going to set up an objective function, and then we're going to optimize that objective function, and we're going to derive an iterative method using EM to maximize that objective function. So EM is an iterative optimization method to estimate some unknown parameters given measurement data. It's used in a variety of contexts to estimate missing data or discover hidden variables. So one of the sort of byproducts of the use of EM is that we're going to establish hidden variables, and we're going to estimate the values of those hidden variables as part of this optimization process. And that's actually very interesting and useful because very often those hidden variables have relevance to the problem that you're trying to solve. For example, they represent hidden states, or they give you some insight into the internal structure of the system. So for example, in an audio application, the observables could be viewed as the feature vectors that you use in your analysis. The hidden variables might correspond to some internal state of the system, such as in speech recognition, hidden variables could be things like phonemes or some kind of acoustic unit that we think is relevant to the problem. And then what we do is we can take the we can establish as the observable variables things like words, and we can take as input things like feature vectors, and then we can essentially find the optimum set of phonemes as well as maximizing the probability of the words given the feature vectors. So it's very common when applying EM to establish these hidden variables, and the ability to estimate those becomes an important part of the overall solution. The intuition behind EM is an old one. We alternate between estimating the unknowns and the hidden variables. This idea has been around for a long time. In fact, it goes back, it seems, many, many years. But in 1977, Dempster and his colleagues proved convergence of this approach, and they explained their relationship to maximum likelihood estimation. So that was significant because even though the technique had been used in the statistics literature for a while, It was with this proof people gained confidence that this process was not heuristic, was actually well-founded mathematically, and could converge to a good solution. And therefore, people began to take a much more serious look at it. It took about 10 years to understand this in the context of hidden Markov models, and then it took about another 10 years to understand this in the context of basic Gaussian estimation and things like that. And today, you will see many, many research papers where EM is used to find the parameters of the model that's being proposed. It's become a de facto way to optimize the parameters of a model. EM alternates between performing an expectation step, known as the E step, which computes an expectation of the likelihood by including the latent or hidden variables as if they were observed, and then a maximization step, which computes the maximum likelihood estimates of the parameters by maximizing the expected likelihood found on the E step. So the way this works is the parameters found on the M step are then used to begin another E step, and the process is repeated. So you will typically compute an expectation of a likelihood, and then you will maximize that likelihood by adjusting your parameters, and then you will go and use those parameters to begin another E step or maximization step. So that process, that two-step process, is what's known as the EM algorithm. And it's really a very simple idea, but turns out it gives very good mathematical properties. This approach is the cornerstone of important algorithms such as hidden Markov modeling and discriminative training, and it's been applied to fields like human language technology and image processing. And you'll see, like I've said, you'll see EM used in many, many places. So what we want to do first is to introduce a theorem or a lemma that's integral to the derivation of EM, and this is known as Jensen's inequality. Jensen's inequality states that if P of X and Q of X are two discrete probability distributions, then the sum of P of X log P of X is greater than or equal to the sum of P of X log Q of X, with equality if and only if P of X is equal to Q of X. Now, what's the significance of this lemma? And where might you have seen this before, this kind of thing before? Information theory, right? What particular topic? I mean, you've seen Jensen's inequality in information theory, but it's related to a concept or a measurement, a way to compare two probability distributions, which is known as divergence. The distance calculation between two probability distributions. So it's related to divergence. Why, if we look at this, this is actually a rather interesting property, because it says that if you have two distributions, P of X and Q of X, P of X log P of X, where do we know that quantity from? Entropy. P of X log P of X is greater than or equal to P of X log Q of X for all P and Q. Now that's if you think about this, this is really interesting, because it's sort of suggesting that the relationship of P of X to the log of P of X is somewhat special, and that there's no other function for which log Q of X times P of X will produce a greater entropy, essentially. And one of the reasons this works is because these are probability distributions, and they're bounded to one. Because obviously if they weren't bounded to 1, this wouldn't hold, because Q of X could be just some very large function. Q of X could just take on infinite values everywhere. right? And that wouldn't, that would, that, this is not true in general. This is only true for probability distributions. And why is that? Well, that's true. What that is, because there's a bound on Q. The sum, the integral or the sum of Q has to be equal to 1. So this is suggesting some kind of, I often like to think of this sort of as a matched filter. You achieve this optimum with P of X log P of X, and no other function achieves that optimum. And that's essentially the principle of divergence as well, a way to measure or compare distributions. So let's go ahead and prove this, and then we'll apply this to the derivation of EM. So the sum of P of X log P of X, if this is going to be true, we can basically just rewrite this as the sum of P of X log P of X minus the sum of P of X log Q of X must be greater than or equal to 0. And there we have the difference of two logarithms, so we can write this as the sum over X of P of X times the log of P of X divided by Q of X, and that must be greater than or equal to 0. We can now multiply by minus 1 and flip this ratio, or just by observation, right, that means that the sum of P of X log Q of X over P of X must be less than or equal to 0. So we can then take this term, and we can write this as the sum of P of X log Q of X over P of X. That must be less than or equal to the sum of P of X times Q of X over P of X minus 1. And so we're just essentially replacing this term with something that's larger than this term. But now that's nice, because now we can write that, we can multiply through here and write that this is essentially, let me say one more thing about this. So we have the log of Q of X over P of X. This is bounded by Q of X over P of X minus 1. And therefore, we can now multiply through and write, in the terms of this term, we can write that this is the sum of the sum of Q of X minus the sum of P of X. And we know that the sums of these two, these are both probability distributions, so they must be equal to 1. So therefore, the difference of those two is 0. So we essentially, the way we prove this is by introducing this bound on the logarithm function. So we've now shown that this inequality holds, and this is known as Jensen's inequality. And it essentially, in a more abstract way, it relates the value of a convex function of an integral to the integral of the convex function, and it's used extensively in information theory. So that we won't dwell on that detail too much, but that's a general, that's sort of a functional analysis way to view the implications of this inequality. This is a bound. You can show that the log of X is always less than or equal to this X minus 1. Let's see, let me think about this. Let me, I'll have to look that up. I believe it's true when x is less than 1, when x is less than 1. But I also believe it's, the constraints are a little stricter than that. And you raise a good point about whether this is true just for these probability distributions which must sum to 1. It's certainly not true in general that the log of x is less than or equal to the x minus 1. Is that true in log of x? Yeah, the log of x is less than x, right? I mean, that we know. That's because the log is a reduction operation, right? And this is saying that the log of x is less than x minus 1. So when x is equal to 1, let's say, the log of x is 0. And x minus 1 is minus 1. So let me get more information on that. Yeah, it's good. I'm missing. Right, right. That's right. That's a good point. So what about 2? Log of 2 is what? Doesn't have a calculator? Log of 2 is like 1.4 or something like that. We can do... Log 2 is 0.03? No. 0.3. Log 2 is 0.3, and 2 minus 1 is 1. So... that's true for x equals 2, that's true. So this might be true in general. Why don't you check 100? Well, no, actually we know that for 100 it's going to be true. So what about 0.5? So the log of 0.5 is 0.7, and 0.5 minus 1 is 1/2, minus 1/2. So it's true. It's not true when x is less than 1. But the other thing here is it's the sum of these two. So let me look into that a little bit more. The reason for that, I don't know why I didn't have that on the slides. Okay. So now let's formally introduce the EM theorem, and then we'll use that result to prove this. So the EM theorem says that T is going to denote some hidden variable. The sum over T of P of theta primed of T given Y times the log of P sub theta of T given Y is greater than the sum over T of P of theta prime of T given Y times the log of P of theta prime So we have on the left here P of theta prime of T given Y log P of theta of T given Y. On the right here, we have P of theta prime T given Y. So this is essentially P of X. And then on the right here, on the second part, we have the log of P of theta versus the log of P of theta prime. So that's the P of X and the Q of X. Okay, so this is essentially setting up an inequality that's very similar to Jensen's inequality. But if this is true, then P sub theta of Y is greater than P theta primed of Y. Now you can After we prove this, we'll talk more about the significance of this result. But you can sort of see what's happening here. If this is true, then one model is more likely than another model. Theta essentially are parameters. So if this property on the left is true, then the model represented by theta has a greater likelihood than the model represented by theta prime. So that's a good thing, because that tells us how to construct a better model for a better model theta, starting with theta prime. All we have to do is construct that model such that this relationship is true. So we'll expand on that in a moment, but for now let's just go ahead and prove this. So let's let y denote observable data. P sub theta primed of y is the probability distribution of y under some model whose parameters are denoted by theta prime. P sub theta of y, let's let that be the corresponding distribution under a different setting, theta. And our goal then is to prove that y is more likely under the model theta than under the model theta prime. So let's let T denote some hidden or latent parameters that are governed by values of theta. Because P of theta primed of T given Y is a probability distribution that sums to 1, we can write that the log of P of sub theta of Y minus the log of P sub theta primed of Y, we can write this as the sum of P sub theta primed of T given Y times the log of P of theta of Y minus the sum of P sub theta primed of T given Y times the log of theta primed of Y. So we're just taking this. We'll see later these are essentially likelihoods. We'll take the difference of these likelihoods and write it in terms of the conditionals. And we denote there's some dependence on Y and T, between Y and T, and we can operate on that using properties of conditional distribution. So what we're going to do here is a little bit of sleight of hand. We're going to take each term and multiply it by this term on the left. We're going to multiply by P of theta of T comma Y divided by P of theta of T comma Y. And then this term on the right, we're going to multiply by P sub theta primed of T and Y divided by P sub theta primed of T and Y. And then we're going to now sort of operate on these things. So this term on the left, we have P of, in the denominator, we have this P of theta, P sub theta of T comma Y. And then in the numerator, we have P sub theta of Y. So if you take the ratio of this to this, that's just the conditional P sub theta of T given Y. And then we can do the same thing on the right, for the right term, and write in the denominator P theta primed of T given Y. We can now expand these out. We have essentially four terms, two terms here, two terms here. So we can expand this out and write this first term, P theta prime of T given Y times the log of the numerator minus the first term times the log of the denominator. And then we have we've got a minus sign here, so we'll flip the two. We've got this P theta prime of T given Y times the log of P theta let me start that again so we get the terms in the right order. So we have this P theta prime and a P times the log of 1 over P of theta of T given Y. So that can be written as minus the product of those two. So that's this last term here. We have P theta prime times the log of P theta, the numerator term, we'll write that here. So this term corresponds to the numerator. This term corresponds to the denominator. This term corresponds to the numerator here. This term, we have a minus, which gives us a plus, corresponds to the denominator here. So we have these four terms now. And we can reduce this to this first term minus this second term. And then we have this term here. This, if you think of this as one term minus the other. Now, we can use Jensen's inequality on that because this is of the form of p of x times the log of p of x minus p of x times the log of q of x. So we can use Jensen's inequality for that and say, well, this must be greater than or equal to zero. We have an equality here, which means that this thing on the left-hand side, if we remove this chunk, which is positive, this must be greater than or equal to just these two terms. So that's the proof. Now, the question is, you know, what exactly have we shown? Well, what we've shown is that if this quantity is greater than zero, then this quantity is greater than zero. Right? Because this has always has to be greater than this. Now, why is this being greater than zero of interest to us? Okay, and why is that useful to us? In what sense? Exactly. So this means that the model denoted by theta gives a higher likelihood, I was looking for the word likelihood, gives a higher likelihood than the model denoted for theta prime. And that now suggests a principled way to find the values of theta. We can use this equation to find the values of theta. And if we use this equation to find the values of theta, then we can be assured that the new values of theta were better than the old values of theta. Better in a log likelihood sense. Not better necessarily in a mean squared error sense, but better in a log likelihood sense. And that's what makes EM different from mean squared error. Though the two are, you know, somewhat related. That this gives you a statistical method, if you will, for finding the parameters of your model. So this suggests a new strategy, a strategy for finding the new parameters. Choose them to make the last quantity positive. So we want to use that. If we start with, we still need a little more explanation here. If we start with the parameter setting theta primed, and we find a parameter setting theta for which our inequality holds, then the observed data y will be more probable under theta than theta prime. That's what we just stated about the likelihoods, the difference in the likelihoods being positive. The name expectation maximization comes about because we take the expectation of this joint probability distribution, p sub theta of t and y, with respect to the old distribution, p sub theta primed of t and y, and then maximize the expectation as a function of the argument theta. So we have the old parameters, theta primed, we have this old distribution, p sub theta primed of t and y, and then we maximize the expectation of this with the old parameters theta prime. We now try to maximize the expectation of that by adjusting theta. And once we do that, then we'll be assured that this inequality will hold. So critical to the success of the algorithm is the choice of these proper intermediate variables t that will allow finding the maximum of the expectation. This is essentially an expectation. So we're going to try to maximize this But to do that, it needs to be done with respect to these intermediate variables. And for most problems that we've applied EM to, the choice of the intermediate variables is not too difficult. And we'll see some examples of that in a moment with hidden Markov models. Perhaps the most prominent use of the EM algorithm in pattern recognition is to derive the Baum-Welsh re-estimation equations for a hidden Markov model. And very often, people get confused between these three terms, the EM algorithm, Baum-Welsh re-estimation, and hidden Markov models. So as we go through hidden Markov models, we'll try to sort that out. But these are essentially three distinct concepts. And then many other re-estimation algorithms have been derived using this approach. I think I have I have a slide on that in a moment, but which we'll talk about that a little bit more. But let me first talk about an example that's given in the textbook. These missing data examples have never thrilled me, but since it's in the textbook, I thought it was worth going through. So we have consider a data set with a missing element. So we have this data set, X1, X2, X3, X4. And for some reason, we don't know the value, one of the values of X4. And you might ask, well, how can we estimate the value of that variable and make it consistent with the other data that we've observed? You could just pick a random value, for example, but you would like to pick a value that what is statistically consistent with everything you've seen previously. So this is one of the classic applications of EM, though, like I said, I'm not too thrilled about missing data problems. But so let us estimate the value of the missing point, assuming a Gaussian model with a diagonal covariance and arbitrary means. So we have now this two-dimensional feature vectors, if you will, or two-dimensional vectors. So we're going to model them as Gaussian. So there's some mean associated with these data, and there's some variance associated with this data. And since this is a two-dimensional problem, there's two means and two variances. And the question that we want to ask is, how can we choose that parameter value that's most consistent with this Gaussian assumption about the data? Now, whether or not the data is Gaussian is a, you know, that's a legitimate question. But it makes, for many reasons that we've discussed previously, it makes sense to assume this data came from some kind of Gaussian model, Gaussian generative model. But we have to, in the process of predicting the best value for that missing data point, we have to somehow come up with estimates of mu1, mu2, sigma1, and sigma2. Those are the hidden variables. So we postulate a model with some hidden variables, and then we're going to essentially estimate the values of the hidden variables and then use that model to generate the best value for the observed data. Okay, does that make some sense? So the expectation step is to take the expectation of the log of this P of theta T given Y, and we do that by essentially taking a statistical expectation. So our Q function, what's often called the Q function, which is a function of theta and theta prime, is going to be the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of, we're going to have the sum over the three data points of the probabilities of those points. So we have the log of P of X sub K given theta plus, we have the sum of these three representing the probabilities of each of these three points, which is going to represent this term, plus we have the fourth, the log of this P of X4 given theta. Now, this is a problem because we don't actually know what this value is. So embedded in this equation is essentially an unknown X4 1. And then we multiply that by the probability of x41 given the parameters theta, and given that x42 I think that should be x42 is equal to 2. Given that x42 is equal to 2, because this is x42. So we have then we can break this this integral up into two integrals, and we have the integral of this, which, since this is a constant with respect to the integration, we just have the integral of a p of x, and that turns out to be 1. So this term essentially comes out as just a constant. And then we have the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of this term, which is the log of the probability of x4 given theta times the probability distribution, which we have a conditional here. So we express that as the conditional of x41 given x42 equal to, I think this should be 2, given theta 0 over the integral of that over all possible values of x41. And and I think the book has the details on this, but assuming normal distributions as initial conditions, this can be simplified to an expression which has this first term, which we can calculate directly because we know all the x's, we know, and the thetas are what we're after, plus this term, which can be shown to simplify to that. So I don't remember if there's a second slide on this. Yeah, not. Okay, so what we've got here . So the Q functions become sort of our machinery for doing the EM optimization. So what we're now going to to do here is to essentially, if you think about this carefully, there's an unknown here, x41. And then there's these mu's and sigmas, which are in the hidden variables. So the process here is to essentially maximize this with respect to x41, and then once we do that, once we have a value of x41, we can re-estimate the means and variances, and then we can go back and generate a new estimate of x41, re-estimate the means and variances, and just keep iterating like that. And that's generally the way EM works. So the key step, the main reason I just wanted to show this example, is the key step in any application of EM is establishing this expectation step where you establish the Q function. And in sometimes this will produce a tractable result. You'll get a set of equations that are fairly easy to solve. A lot of times it'll produce a set of equations that are very nonlinear and very difficult to solve. And that's why there's only a handful of problems that have had nice, clean solutions to this. In a lot of cases, we end up having to apply numerical techniques to do the maximization step, to find the new values of the parameters that maximize the Q function given the previous, giving the current values or previous values. And it's not uncommon in problems dealing with Gaussians to make assumptions about things like diagonal covariance and such, because that just limits the, makes the equation simpler, essentially. It also sometimes helps you to decouple the equations. Now, the second thing that we'll do is to apply this to hidden Markov models, which we'll go through the derivations next class. What I want to do today is just briefly introduce that. But before I do that, I wanted to point out that an excellent tutorial on EM estimation using Gaussians. What's become very popular in recent years is to estimate, to model your data as a mixture of Gaussian distributions, and then to estimate the parameters of those Gaussians, the mixture coefficients, the means and covariances of those Gaussian distributions using EM. And this is something that you can do independent of hidden Markov models or anything like that. If I just give you a pot of data, you can apply a mixed Gaussian mixture model to that data using EM. And this paper has an excellent, fairly easy to read derivation of that result. You can find code to do this in MATLAB, for example. MATLAB has pretty good support for this. And this is something as graduate students that you might actually find yourself doing at some point. So I think it's worth reading. The derivations get a little bit messy because they're not clean. They're not completely clean for the general case. They're reasonably clean for diagonal covariances and such, but it's not entirely clean for the unconstrained case. Secondly, there's a nice demo showing the convergence of EM. One of the things that's been discussed throughout the literature a lot in the past 5-10 years is the fact that EM is a very rapid convergence to what it thinks is the optimal solution. So after, in a speech recognition system, for example, with where we may be training millions of parameters, we find after only 3 iterations, we get a pretty good level of convergence. In fact, we typically will iterate only 3 or 4 times in a speech recognition system when we're doing EM. And if you think about that, that's pretty remarkable that in 3 iterations, you get most of the way to your final solution. And if you iterate another 50 times, you don't get much farther. That's because EM is very aggressive in the way it tries to approach the final answer. Now, that may be a bad thing if the final answer it's approaching is not the best answer. And the consequence of that is that sometimes EM, when you have a highly multidimensional optimization space, EM can get stuck in local optimum. And this has been studied extensively over the years. People have developed techniques like simulated annealing and such to try to prevent that. But EM is what's often called a very strong convergence. And sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. And there's been a lot of discussion about other techniques that don't converge as quickly so that maybe you have a better chance of finding the global optimum if your parameter space has a lot of suboptimal points in it. So anyway, so this is a nice little demonstration. Shows you step by step how quickly EM converges, and you can play around with that and see the convergence. And it's a nice demo. Now, what I wanted to do for a couple minutes at the end of today's lecture is to just let you start thinking about something. And, of course, we'll do this in the context of gambling because gambling is this great opportunity to explain most things in life. So when I first learned about hidden Markov models, this coin-tossing experiment was one of the ways that people like to introduce the topic, kind of famous within the speech literature. And it's a really nice example of the potential power of something like hidden Markov models. And the scenario goes something like this. Suppose, just to make it a little more interesting, suppose you're at a casino. And somebody tells you, behind the wall there, somebody has flipped a coin and generated this sequence of observations. Heads, heads, tails, 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 heads, tails. Could you actually figure out how many coins were tossed by looking at that data? Because maybe the person behind the wall actually flipped 2 coins or 3 coins or four coins, or one coin? Could you infer something about the model just being given the output data? Now, why might that ability be of use to you as future pattern recognition scientists? The ability to infer the underlying model structure from just the observable, just the signal. Why might that be of use to you? And if you don't come up with a good answer, I'm going to have to talk about speech recognition. So that's the ground rule. If you get tired of hearing about speech recognition, give me some other examples I can work with. Turns out this is really useful for speech recognition. Why? How do you think humans actually recognize speech? Well, true. That'll get you a couple points on an exam. What do you think is the essence of speech production and speech perception? What makes a sound a sound, a particular type of sound? Okay, and what causes those changes in air pressure? From your lungs, you push air up through the vocal tract mechanism. But what really differentiates from t? The position of what we call your articulators. So if I want to do a perfect job of speech recognition and you're only given the signal, why might this technology be useful to you? Why might the EM theorem be useful to you? Why might hidden Markov modeling be useful to you? You could, in theory, do a perfect job of speech recognition. And this has been what we call the holy grail in speech recognition for many years. Using these hidden modeling techniques to take the signal and convert it to something meaningful like articulator position. But to do that completely automatically, the alternative would be to actually have to put you in front of an X-ray machine. And people have actually done this. And you might have seen some audiovisual systems now with cameras on PCs where they demonstrate they can actually take pictures of your lips and record the audio and do a better job of speech recognition. But that's kind of uncomfortable to have somebody that's very invasive, right? So maybe we can do this automatically. Maybe we can take the signal and go from signal to articulator positions and do that in some kind of statistically optimal way to get the best guess of those articulator positions. This is a vision that has been driving speech recognition research for many years. The articulator positions, guess what, are going to be our hidden variables. And the parameters of those of that model are going to be our theta, and we're going to find the theta using EM and ultimately using hidden Markov models. But the hidden Markov model piece is not sort of a detail. So there's one example of how introduction of these hidden variables is actually a good thing because it's something we can use to solve the problem. Now, but that won't make you a lot of money. Gambling will make you a lot of money. So why is it so useful to you in a gambling sense? Well, in a gambling sense, suppose one of those coins is actually biased. Suppose you can postulate a model that allows you to detect and model that biased coin. With that knowledge, gambling is all about you having better knowledge than what's called the house or your opponent. Because you're ultimately trying to predict a little bit better than your opponent. And all you need is some little delta better in your ability to predict, and you can win an infinite amount of money in gambling. Because over the long haul, you will do better on the average than your opponent, and you will win. This is a very interesting, very simple concept in gambling. There's an information theory theorem on this. Now, it turns out for this sequence, there's many different models that could have produced this. So we'll talk next time a little bit about how we can actually model the data. But any of these models are legitimate models of that observation sequence. And the question is really, can we use EM to determine what's the best model? And then this approach, this is another classic example that was used, trying to figure out when you're drawing colored balls from an urn, whether you have one urn, two urns, three urns, and so forth. Again, a hidden modeling type problem. And we'll talk about with hidden Markov models the ability to build and train models like this and then do inference based on the model. And that's a very, very powerful technology. And it's one of the things I hope you'll take away from in this course, because this whole process of hidden state modeling is really what's been very popular over the last 10, 20 years in pattern recognition. Okay, see you on Friday. And I'll